Doris Kearns Goodwin, one of America's most beloved historians, will discuss her new book, An Unfinished Love Story, A Personal History of the 1960s, with me at Universal Preservation Hall in Saratoga Springs on Sunday, June 2nd at 3 p.m. An Unfinished Love Story weaves together biography, memoir, and history. Doris Kearns Goodwin takes us along on the emotional journey that she and her husband, Dick Goodwin, embarked upon in the last years of his life as the couple examined a tumultuous decade in American history through the lens of their own personal involvement in public service. Again, the name of the book is An Unfinished Love Story, A Personal History of the 1960s. It is always a thrill to welcome Doris Kearns Goodwin to the roundtable. Thank you so much for being with us.
I'm very glad to be with you again. Feel like old friends.
Yes, indeed. I look forward to our event on the 2nd. I don't want to put people into a panic, but tickets are selling out really quickly. So if you want to get in, like, you should get them right away, because I just checked the theater, which is gorgeous, UPH, and there are not many seats left. So if you want in, now's the time to do it. At what point did you think that you wanted to write this, of to look at a personal history of this decade that meant so much to you and meant so much to your husband?
Well, the book really had its own journey, and it changed from one thing to another. The whole idea for going through these 300 boxes that he had saved during his entire public life really were a time capsule of the 60s, and they slept with us everywhere, from one place to another, from a garage to a storage unit to a barn, until he turned 80. And then he finally decided, he came down the stairs one morning, it's now or never, I'm ready to open them. And the reason he hadn't wanted to open them for so many years was that a decade had ended so sadly, with his great friend Bobby Kennedy being killed. He was with him when he died, Martin Luther King's assassination, the riots in the streets, the campus violence, that it felt like he just wanted to move forward rather than back. But he finally decided, he said in his typical way, if I have any wisdom to dispense now that I'm 80, I better start dispensing it now. So we made a deal that every weekend we'd go through the boxes, but we would start chronologically, not knowing what was going to come next, so that we didn't let that sadness of the future affect our excitement and exhilaration of living through those boxes, which had memos and diaries and letters, and so much had been saved. And then my own experience, being 12 years younger, came into it as well. So we relived our youth, which was a wonderful thing to do in the last years of his life.
Let's just for a moment remind audiences, but you were very much a part of administrations and working with Lyndon Johnson. He was one of the greatest public policy speechwriters ever. How did the two of you get together and meet?
Well, it was not until our experience with Lyndon Johnson and the 60s was over. I was a young assistant professor at Harvard, and we had our history department and government department offices in this little yellow house. And one morning we heard that Richard Goodwin was coming to get an office space to finish a book there. And we were all excited. There was a feeling that we had heard that we knew he had worked for JFK and LBJ, that he had been at defining moments at every moment, it seemed, of the 60s. He'd been with Senator Eugene McCarthy in New Hampshire, with Bobby Kennedy, was close to Jackie. And so we heard he was brash and arrogant, but really interesting. So, of course, that sounded interesting to me. I was in my office, and he just sort of plopped in and sat down on a chair, and he started out, so you're a graduate student, right? And I said, no, I'm an assistant professor, and I told him all the courses I was teaching. And then he said, I know, I'm just teasing you. I know you worked for Lyndon after I did. And then we started talking that day and went to dinner that night and essentially never stopped talking for the 42 years we were married.
One of the things that you talk about in the books are more than the 300 boxes of letters, diaries, documents, memorabilia that your husband carted around. And while he carted it around, he didn't really look at it very much. It was largely unexamined for five decades. And so in going through it, Was it easy to then start kind of piecing it all together, or was that a real slog?
No, it was very exciting to me. I had seen little bits of it years before, and I knew that there was great stuff in there, so I couldn't wait till he made this decision. But what was so different for me was that I'm used to big archives for the people that I've studied, you know, Lyndon Johnson, at the beginning, and then obviously Franklin Roosevelt, Teddy Roosevelt, and Abraham Lincoln. And I got so close to them because it took me so long to write those books, longer to write about the Civil War than the war talks to be fought. Mm. And I used to call them my guys because I felt close to them. But now here was my guy. And as I'm going through his archive, he's right across the room from me. So I used to talk to my guys before that, and they never answered me, of course. But now he would talk to me, correct me, argue with me. And we brought with us in this adventure certain loyalties, he to the Kennedys and me to Lyndon Johnson, that became most of our marriage a kind of argument. I would say that not until LBJ came along was the vision of JFK ever put into law. He would say yes, but he inspired the nation. And it was actually more serious than that. But it was wonderful to be able to just start fresh. And I could feel what young John Kennedy was like and feel why it was Dick admired him so much. And he came to understand again what he had known about Lyndon Johnson all along, but had somehow broken with him on the war and allowed that resentment to last much of his life until we went through the boxes.
So you have an opportunity to really make fresh assessments on these huge figures.
That's what I felt. I mean, for example, Dick was on the plane with John Kennedy, this Caroline plane, a small prop plane during the whole campaign of 1960. So I felt like I was reliving that campaign through Dick's eyes and watching John Kennedy grow. You know, you read a history book and you already assume he's that great speaker that he became. He wasn't very polished at the beginning. In fact, he spoke so fast, it was said, and he never let the audience absorb what he was saying. And then he rushed off the stage as if he were a student getting rid of a report and going back to his seat. But the great thing about him was that he asked the reporters, how did I do? Where did I lose the audience? Where did I work well? And so he learned from his mistakes over and over again. I watched him with Dick after the Bay of Pigs fiasco had taken place. A week later, he was going to have his first press conference. So he called his aides, including Dick, together to talk about how he should deal with his problem with the press. He'd been so depressed all week. Jackie had said that the first time, really, he wept in her hands. And then he went before the press. He was going to meet them later that day. And he asked his own aides, what should I do? And they all were saying, well, the State Department was at fault. You know, the CIA was at fault, the generals. He said, no, it was my responsibility. And don't even talk about that. He went and took responsibility with that famous phrase, success has 1,000 fathers, defeat is an orphan. And his polls went up to 83%. People just really want people to learn how to acknowledge their errors and learn from their mistakes. And then he grew as a result of that, changed his structure, and the Cuban Missile Crisis was much more important, and he handled it so well.
One of the things that you write about in the book, a quote from your husband, the end of our country has loomed many times before. America is not as fragile as it seems. This is something that he would often remind you of.
Absolutely. I mean, he realized he had the same feeling I did as an historian, and he as somebody who was working on shaping history, that he understood that the most important changes for social justice had taken place when there was citizen activism that pushed the government from the outside in, most notably, of course, the civil rights movement, which he was intimately involved with in helping Lyndon Johnson on his great civil rights speeches, Great Society speech. And they provided the foundation, really. They fired the conscience of the country through the marches and demonstrations that allowed the country to be moved forward by the government. And he said that each time in history that had happened before, whether it was Lincoln and the anti-slavery movement or the progressive movement at the turn of the 20th century, or the civil rights movement, or the gay rights movement, or the women's movement. So he had optimism that even when things seemed stuck, he wasn't around now, of course, to see the real trouble we're in right now, but he had optimism that somehow the citizens would come through again.
I was going to say, I mean, you look at the country now, and it's pretty darn fragile, and it feels very fragile. And I want to think that the end of our country has loomed, and we have worked around it, and it's not as fragile as it seems. Although, I mean, just looking at, you know, a Supreme Court and looking at immunity yesterday of something that they didn't ever even have to think about for 200 plus years that suddenly is on the table seems to me that we're at a very fragile place.
I guess that's the wonderful thing for me about the solace that history can provide. It is a really tough time, but we've lived through really, really, really tough times before. I mean, just imagine what it was like for Lincoln coming into his term as president 7 states already seceding from the Union, a civil war about to kill 600,000 or more people about to begin. And he said if he had ever known what it was going to be like in those first 3 months, he would not have thought he could have lived through it. And yet somehow we did. By the end, the Union was restored and emancipation was secured. And the thing is, I often talk about the fact, and that's what Dick and I felt by going through the boxes chronologically, you have to live with the people at the time to know what they were feeling. They don't know the end of their story. We know now that these things worked out all right. The Civil War, the Great Depression comes to an end with a mobilization for the war, and the World War II, the Allies win, but they didn't know that. So they had the anxiety we have, but somehow we emerged from all those other troubles with great strength. And think about the 1960s. I mean, when the civil rights movement was marching in Birmingham, and it was a children's crusade, they were set upon by Bull Connor and the dogs and the big pressured hoses. But that fired the conscience of the people. And that was when John Kennedy introduced the Civil Rights Bill. It was the marchers in Selma who were attacked by the Alabama state troopers, a really low moment in our history. I remember watching that Bloody Sunday on television. It just seemed, could this be America? The same thing we may be asking ourselves today. And yet somehow their bravery and their courage and the reaction on the part of the Alabama state troopers so shocked the nation that that helped Lyndon Johnson to decide to make a joint sessions of Congress speech on voting rights. And my husband was honored to help him working on that speech. And then a Voting Rights Act passed 5 or 6 months later. So these dark moments in our history have also produced great moments in moving forward to social justice.
Talk to me about how the two of you worked together on this. You have 300 boxes before you, and how you realize a map, a plan of how you're going to go through and tell this story.
Yeah, I'm not sure we realized it fully as we were going along. All we knew that somehow I wanted to help him in his voice write a book about this whole process of going through the boxes. And what happened was in the last couple of years of his life, as he was getting older, and he also He also got cancer. And in that last year, he was so absorbed in the boxes that I think it kept him feeling a sense of purpose. It kept him joyful in the morning, wanting to wake up for us to do this. I think we had this kind of talismanic feeling that as long as we kept having more boxes to open, that he would stay alive and we'd have this job to do together on this great adventure. And then when he died, there were still boxes to go through. We hadn't really written very much yet. And I had to decide what to do, and it was really hard. I had to make a decision to move from Concord, where we had lived for all our married life, into Boston. Our house was just too big, 10,000 books. It was too sad to be in the rooms where he had filled every room, it seemed. And that took time up. And then I came in. It was COVID when I got into Boston. And I finally decided that I'd made him a promise that I would help him on this, and now it would have to be me to write the book. And that meant being an historian and also a journalist in a way, because there were so many unfinished stories. I wanted to interview people who we had not had a chance to talk to ourselves. You know, so for example, there was the first Coast Guard black man named Merle Smith, and I interviewed his widow and talked to her about what it was like for him to be a trailblazer. I interviewed these two young graduate students at the University of Michigan who were there with the birth of the Peace Corps, when John Kennedy came and spoke there just for 3 minutes, and somehow without even mentioning the word Peace Corps, the Peace Corps has developed from the students themselves who signed a petition for 1,000 kids to be willing to give 2 years of their life to this non-existent Peace Corps. So I really felt like I was going to get the rest of the stories that Dick and I had not been able to uncover, things he had wanted to do. So it became this hybrid of biography, history, and memoir.
It has to be intertwined with grief and trying to come to terms with that as well.
I think you're right. I mean, I think in the end, what I realized is that all my life, I really tried to bring previous presidents who were no longer alive to life, that you want readers to feel who they were and what they did, the kind of people they were. And now here was a chance when I finally realized that I could try to do this, to keep my husband alive in my memory and hopefully in the memory of others. And it's really what we all want to do. I mean, one of the things I've thought about because of talking a little bit about the book in the last week and a half since it's been out is people have talked to me about the fact that they have boxes in their attics or they have memorabilia or they have scrapbooks. And the main advice would be don't wait if your parent or grandparent has such things together until afterwards. And you go through that sad process of having to sort through them. If you can talk to them now and get those memories alive. And then you know those people. They have stories then to tell your children, grandchildren, your friends, and your colleagues. That's how people live on forever. And that's what I've tried to do with history, but we can do it in our own families. And so that's been an exhilarating part of just running around talking about the book a little bit, thinking that for maybe some other people. And I also love to have the idea that the people who are in my generation now, who lived through the 60s, all that experience, it was a decade that was really impelled by young people believing that they could make a difference. So from the people in the civil rights movement and the Peace Corps, the women's movement, the gay rights movement, that all occurred in the 60s, powered by that thought that if you work together collectively, change could happen. And I love for those people who are fading, my generation is dying off, to be able to tell the grandchildren about that, who may be questioning whether they can make a difference right now, about what it was like. And maybe that conversation could be had between grandparents and grandchildren.
That so struck me in the book, because obviously the two of you led very full and vital and amazing lives. But reading about your lives as young people and what you were doing and the advantages that you took and the challenges you lived through is really incredible.
Oh, well, thank you so much. I mean, it really was, you know, not all decades are as exciting as others. But there was a lot of things. People believed in politics then. Politics seemed like an honorable vocation. We had large leaders. All of them, of course, had their flaws. But I think about how much was accomplished, especially through the Great Society. And what was fun is, you know, obviously, when you talk about the origins of the Great Society, then, you know, Dick has a story that it all really began when he and Bill Moyers and President Johnson were swimming naked in a pool, in the White House pool. And Johnson wanted to talk about his vision for whatever the Johnson program would be after the Kennedy program. So the stories are at the core of what the boxes produced. There were letters to his best friend when he was in Harvard Law School. There are letters to his parents. There are memos, all the drafts of the speeches he worked on, letters from Jackie Kennedy, letters from Bobby Kennedy, and memos. And, you know, that's the way, as an historian, those are the sources you love somehow. You're looking over the shoulder of somebody writing a letter. And here was my husband writing these letters that I hadn't seen until this period of time.
Doris Kearns Goodwin will discuss her new book, An Unfinished Love Story, with me at Universal Preservation Hall in Saratoga Springs on Sunday, the 2nd of June at 3 p.m. You can find out more information by going to northshire.com, northshire.com. Doris Kearns Goodwin, I can't wait to see you on the 2nd. Thank you so much, and I so appreciate you sharing with us this morning.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I can't wait to see you too. We'll have a good time together.
Indeed. Be well. Thank you so much.
You too. Bye.
Bye-bye. Again, Doris Kearns Goodwin's new book is An Unfinished Love Story, A Personal History of the 1960s. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.